My recovery was important to me. I mean, I was diagnosed in jail during my last sentence in 2010. And for me, it answered the question that I had had for most of my life. What's wrong with me and why do I feel the way that I do?
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the foundation, our history, and our programs, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. The Hogg Foundation has long advocated for the expansion of peer support services as a way to address our state's mental health workforce shortage. But does peer support also have a role to play in criminal justice? Our first guest, Romy Zarate, suffered from substance abuse for most of her life, as well as the effects of childhood trauma. After several stints in jail, she discovered the peer support program at Texas Tropical Behavioral Health in the Rio Grande Valley. It was there that she found a new calling and has been providing peer support to female inmates ever since. She is here with us to discuss the theory and practice of reentry peer support. Romy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be a part of this.
So it seems to me that every time there's a story about a peer specialist, the tendency is to have them lead with their story. For this, I want to change things up a bit and have you lead with your skills first. What does your workday at Tropical consist of, and what kinds of skills are necessary for what you do?
Well, my day consists of serving people in recovery that have reentered the community from incarceration. It entails many things that are person-centered, and they can vary from connecting them to resources like housing, SNAP food assistance, SSI, SSDI benefits, Medicaid, WIC for those who are pregnant or with child, low-cost medical care, indigent services, cell phone assistance, transportation to services and appointments, legal services, retrieving identification documents, substance abuse treatment, employment readiness, and of course, symptom management and learning about their diagnosis. Coming out of the criminal justice system for many means starting over with nothing. My main objective is to help support those in recovery that are diagnosed with one of the primary mental illnesses that we treat here at the center and help them meet their recovery goal. Our objective is to reduce hospitalizations, reduce recidivism, and to have them be successful in reentering the community. The skills that helps me most is my passion to serve, and also my ability to identify with their needs, because I've experienced this myself. I never had a peer upon my release, and I had to learn how to reenter on my own. I had legal issues, child custody battles, my addiction, transportation issues, a felony conviction, family problems, I had shelter needs, outstanding student loans, bills, and I was still learning how to cope with my symptoms. But I was resourceful and I looked for programs and information on the internet. My recovery was important to me. I mean, I was diagnosed in jail during my last sentence in 2010. And for me, it answered the question that I had had for most of my life. What's wrong with me and why do I feel the way that I do?
What is the workload like? I mean, what's a typical situation that you encounter on the job?
A typical day on the job means going to a person's home, working on skills building, much on accessing resources, talking about how to move forward and progress, instilling hope with my story, and sharing how I overcame many barriers. I'm often transporting the people I serve to various state agencies, shelters, charity drives, or providing informal support to doctor's appointments, meetings, NA meetings, and such. In the jail system, I facilitate a peer group, currently just for females, where I meet with the inmates inside the jail who are diagnosed with a mental illness. It's a 12-week group that is designed to educate them on mental illness, teach skills building, engage in recovery-oriented topics and activities, and preparing them to re-enter the community. The group, it's conducted once a week for an hour, but it's going to expand to males and will include another day and time slot to meet with them at another housing unit. And then other times I'm researching, entering documentation, taking continuing education classes, staffing with other members of the team about the participants, and doing many other tasks.
So peers have an interesting status, it seems to me, somewhere between a friend and a caseworker. And one thing that I've always wondered is how challenging it must be to maintain an emotional distance when you identify so strongly with the group that you're trying to help. So I was just curious as to how you navigate that.
It's extremely challenging, but I've learned that boundaries are a must. Early on at the center, peers were allowed to give out our personal cell phones. Okay, I was getting calls throughout the night. I sometimes get Facebook friend requests, and if you cross that line, you're opening a can of worms if the relationship goes sour. I mean, you could be blackmailed into doing things outside your scope of duties or be asked for money. You could be falsely accused of abuse or misconduct. So I learned really early on that boundaries are healthy for both the peer and the person being served. In the beginning, I remember wanting to be a superhero, but I learned that my job is to teach, model, share, and be supportive, not to save the world. A person could quickly become codependent on their peer, and one of the most important objectives is to learn self-sufficiency. So in doing everything for them, you defeat that purpose, and they can become reliant on the center and you, and there's only so much that we can do.
So about your story, what experiences formed you? And perhaps you could give a synopsis of how you got to where you are today.
Sure, Ike. As you mentioned before, I did suffer from trauma. Early on in my life, it was a series of unfortunate events. I experienced trauma early on in life, and that shaped and changed me into who I am today. I was involved in a head-on collision on the way to school with my parents and sister at the age of 7. My mother died in that accident. Not only did I experience immense emotional pain, but physical pain as well, as I nearly lost my life too. I only remember bits and pieces, but what I can remember is pretty gruesome. My aftercare then was taken on by my aunt, who was my mother's sister, and she was married to an alcoholic. I was molested for close to 3 years in their care, and I never got any form of counseling for the accident or the sexual abuse. And this is concerning to me now as I think of the children that are going through this today. I began using drugs early on in my life. My father's family were like the party type, while my mother's side were college grads with no addiction in the family as far as I know. But after I had said something about the abuse, my mother's family became detached. So I was more exposed to my father's side. I later had 2 children at the age of 16 and 18. I moved on and out of the valley to Austin, where in my mind was a chance to escape the cesspool of drugs here and the domestic violence I was experiencing here with my husband at the time. Austin was wonderful. Opportunity was everywhere, and my husband and I flourished. But the problem was that even though he withdrew from abusing me, I just could never forgive him. So we had many troubles and eventually separated. I remember excelling rather quickly in my jobs, often taking on leadership roles and stuff like that. But I would crash and burn after only a couple of years. I'd either quit or I'd move on to something else. So I really wasn't stable. I was promiscuous. I relied many nights on alcohol to sleep, and my moods were ever changing. I remember being very explosive, yelling a lot, and I often acted on my impulses. It was like do or die, just do. And I was just so many things that I couldn't see at the time. And now looking back, I'm, a little appalled, but I started using drugs again there in Austin socially. But then, gradually I started losing control over everything, including my finances, my ability to pay rent, and being able to care for the kids. So they moved back home here with their father, and I stayed up in Austin. And that proved to be the biggest mistake I ever made because my children, in fact, actually kept me grounded. I mean, if I went too far, my responsibility to them would pull me back. But now here I was alone, partying and getting into heavier drugs. I started using crystal meth, and within 4 months, I had lost everything. I became homeless, got arrested for the first time at the age of 30. I signed for probation, but I failed my first UA and was asked to return in 2 weeks to go to rehab. But instead, I went on the run, homeless, addicted, and on the streets of Austin for 2 years. I was in a constant state of psychosis. Attempted suicide, contemplated suicide every single day. I even lost my son to foster care. And so it was hell. It was utter hell. And I finally, after a couple of years of my son being in foster care, I was like, it was around Thanksgiving. I used to cook Thanksgiving dinner every year for them. So it was super hard. And I said, you know what? I need to turn myself in. I'm gonna die out here. Either someone's gonna kill me, I'm gonna be at the wrong place at the wrong time in the drug scene, or I'm gonna kill myself. So I called the cops, let them know, come pick me up. I am an addict. I need to get off the street and I have a warrant. So they picked me up. I went into jail, and 3 months into my sentence, I was still having psychosis. I was having a lot of nightmares. I couldn't sleep, and I was like, hey, I'm off the drugs. Like, why am I still experiencing these things? So I put in a request to talk to the doctor, and he immediately diagnosed me with bipolar disorder and PTSD. And so finally had the answer to that question of, why do I feel this way and what's wrong with me? So, I immediately started to feel better as I began my medication treatment. I attended classes that were offered there in Del Valle. I was able to see my son with little visits that participating in that program. And once I was released, I immediately came here to Tropical, began my treatment. I was completely honest and open with them about my addiction, even though I had fear. I had fear that, I had my daughter who wasn't in foster care, and I was like, man, I don't want them to take her away, but I need help. I don't want to go back to the drugs. It was still calling me, go back to Austin, go back to the drugs, and I didn't want that to happen. So they treated me here. That's one thing that I learned was the co-occurring disorders. You have to treat both. You can't just treat one. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So got the treatment. I ended up overcoming all those barriers and doing all the things that I now do with the people that I serve. I had to get the identification card. I had to get my driver's license was suspended. I had a surcharge of over $2,500 that I figure out how I was going to do. So I just began tackling the internet, and I learned about indigent programs and all of these things. My student loan was discharged. I applied for disability. I fought and won after a year of battling CPS for my son. I got him back, and I began working for Tropical. And so I was working as a certified peer specialist, not necessarily in the jails yet, just here with those that wanted a peer. And then I was given the wonderful opportunity to apply for the Via Hope PR Voice Project. And that project allowed me to come and give an idea of what I wanted to do, or I thought that, mental health could use. And that for me, I mean, I remembered the parenting class that I took in jail at Del Valle, and I said, it would be really nice to have something like this for those suffering from mental illness. And presented it, the Voice Project showed me how to network and how to, not necessarily they didn't open all the doors for me, but they kind of, guided me on how I could get that to happen. And Cameron County here, our local county, they agreed, they approved for me to go in there and do this this peer group. And then once I was doing that, it kind of got around in the peer world that I was doing this group. And I in that time, Wendy Latham was writing the Writer 73 grant, and Via Hope presented me with the application to give to my center to apply for the grant and be a part of it, and we were accepted. And so now, you know, I'm working and doing reentry, which is the center of my work. It is my passion, and it is my hope that this is available to every inmate across the United States in every county.
Okay. So beyond mere survival, but true recovery. And that's sort of a mantra for us here at the Hogg Foundation. Romy Zarate, thank you so much, not only for imparting some knowledge, but also yourself being such a wonderful illustration of what it is that we tend to mean by recovery whenever we invoke that word here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
All the innovative ideas in the world don't amount to much without the right policy environment in which they can be championed. Our next guest is Reggie Smith, a peer policy fellow for Communities for Recovery. He speaks from the perspective of someone who has both policy knowledge and the lived experience of someone who has been through the criminal justice system. Reggie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So explain Writer 73 to us. What was its charge, and what has been the result so far?
So during the 85th or 84th legislative session in 2015, inserted into that budget was Rider 73, which was based on a mental health services for adult strategy to implement health and peer support reentry programs. So the Department of State Health Services was going to partner with local mental health authorities, county sheriffs, and we're going to establish a pilot program that use certified peer support specialists to ensure that individuals with justice involvement and mental health conditions successfully transition from the county jail back into the community and found the appropriate clinical services that they needed.
And about how many are being served?
Well, the data that we have right now, the latest data that we have right now was from 2016, October 2016. And at that time, there had been 48 people that had been served. But you have to understand that when this pilot initially started, the first thing they had to do, they had startup issues. You know, they had to find people who needed to be trained, who had criminal justice involvement, they had to have the certification process. They also had to find participants. There was, you know, also issues with finding accommodations within the jails, private and semi-private accommodations. So the people in the program, the participants could be seen. So it took a little while to get started. Now, in 2017, it's projected that over 400 people will be going through this pilot program. So all three of the pilots are up and running at this time, and they're fully staffed. So in 2017 will probably be a better indication of the efficacy of this.
Okay. And are there any successful models for this type of work that we can build upon here in Texas?
Well, you have to look at PeerStar in Pennsylvania. They are the leaders. They started this. And also, there are some other programs around the country. In Arizona, there's a program, I think it's called Project Hope, and it's unique because they work with people coming out of the jails, and they give them rides when they get out, and they really work with them very closely. And that's one of the strengths of peer support. It's not like being a case manager or even a sponsor. So you have a lot of latitude, and you're able to work, you know, really closely with the individuals.
Okay, so now we get to find out a little bit more about you, who you are, where you come from your own point of view, as a man who has been through it and has a deep stake in the issue. What makes community reentry, first of all, so important, but also such a challenging proposition for so many?
Well, why community reentry is so important is because, I mean, we want to reduce the prison population. I mean, obviously, we have just gone over the rails with incarcerating people. But if we are going to reduce the prison population, then we also have a responsibility to ensure that the people who are transitioning back into society have the proper supports and resources in order to have a successful transition. So I think one of the most important things for me was having support, but I didn't have peer support. But so now working in the peer support, field, I see just how much I could have really benefited from it if I would have had the opportunity to have a peer support specialist working with me. And because it's a unique transition, you're dealing with someone who has a dual stigma. You have someone that has a substance use disorder or a mental health condition coupled with justice involvement. So it's really hard for that person to make a transition, and they need someone who really understands all the challenges and barriers that they're going to face, during that transition. But I think when they see folks like myself who have successfully done it, then it gives them hope and it helps motivate them. And it also gives them someone who they can kind of model after. So from my own experience, I didn't have the benefit of having a peer support specialist when I was transitioning back into society. I was fortunate because it seems like every step of the way, every crucial point in my reentry, someone came along and helped me. But I often thought, what would have happened to me if that didn't occur? It could have just been one time and I might not have been able to accomplish the things that I've been able to accomplish. So that's why I understand how important peer support is. Having people who have already walked the walk and can help folks transition, that kind of ensures that it's not just a crapshoot or just by chance. You have people in place that can help folks through every, barrier that they face, through every challenge that they face. And it's just not left up to chance anymore. And in this way, more people are able to achieve their goals in life and to reach their full potential. And I think that's the best thing about peer support.
And that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. Before I go, you ought to know that our first guest, Romy Zarate, is featured in one of the grantee success stories that's currently on the Hogg Foundation website. If you go to our website, Hogg, and that's HOGG.utexas.edu, on our in the main menu, if you click grantees and grant seekers, and then on the drop down select grantees and initiatives, at the bottom of that page is where you'll find our grantee success stories. The first one, mental illness and peer support, is the one that features Romy. And so we very much would like for you to check that out. The communications staff here spent quite a bit of time working on the grantee success stories, and there will be more to come. And we absolutely would like to get your feedback on them. So that does it for Into the Fold. This is Ike Evans of Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. Thank you so much for listening.